Welcome to The Rest is Shifty, a podcast highlighting the eclectic legacy of Shifty Records, South Africa's fiercely independent cult record label operating through the dark days of apartheid into the democratic era. I'm Warwick Sony.
And I'm Lloyd Ross. Each episode will feature a classic album from our catalogue. Today, The Other White Album.
Today on The Rest is Shifty, it's going to be the Other White Album, but I think it's more like the Cherry-Faced Lurchers, which was two albums. The first was Live at Jameson's, which was one of the first albums that we recorded in our mobile studio. We pulled the caravan up to the Jameson's Club in Johannesburg, ran cables down the stairs. It was a basement club, and recorded two nights of James Phillips's Cherry-Faced Lurchers. They had a kind of residency there, and they were the band of the Jamisons. They sort of kicked the whole thing off, really, and made it into the popular venue that it became in the mid-80s.
I heard about this new disco. I really wanted to dance.
The Cherry-Faced Lurchers I first saw at Wits, and they had a drummer, I remember, who was so drunk, he fell off his stool all the time. And I remember thinking it was the most curious band I'd ever seen, because I knew James Phillips' stuff from the Corporals as a punk band. Very inspiring, and as far as punk bands went, they were it. They sang with South African accents, they sang about...
Things that actually really concerned us.
Yeah, it's amazing, as white thing, South African men.
It's the kind of popular culture we didn't have here.
Yeah.
You know, where we actually had a musical group that was basically singing our thoughts.
Yeah.
As liberal-leaning, I suppose you could say, white South Africans.
We weren't ashamed about being white. You know, there was a sort of a cultural thing where there were apologists, you know, especially intellectually and academically and stuff, where, I mean, do you remember?
Irene Stefani.
Irene.
Yeah. I'm sorry I'm white.
I'm sorry I'm white. That was very, very clever, because it's no good being sorry you're white. It's actually part of finding a hole. And James is actually quite articulate in a lot of his lyrics about this wholeness. He's got a lot of optimism as well as a kind of a way of seeing, that he, like Moses, for instance, song Moses
from a later album.
Yeah. It's a similar sensibility of...
about Nelson Mandela.
Yeah, but it's quite funny, and it's got a... When your hat is at a skew angle, that kind of jauntiness. He had a sort of a rakish angle way of seeing things.
But at the same time, a lot of premonition in those lyrics. We'll get to that album, which was called Sunny Skies, later, which wasn't actually the Cherry-Faced Lurchers. It was... The Lurchers.
Oh, is that The Lurchers?
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got a separation between... Okay, so James Phillips falls into various chronological categories, you could say. He had corporal punishment. He was part of illegal gatherings with Carl Robenheim.
Also with Carl Robenheim.
Yeah. So the two people from Corporals form illegal gathering.
If Johnny Cool lived, he'd be in the lounge of the Ribeca Hotel.
Quite a charming Porter Studio recording, and it had The Voice of Noit also was part of that.
It was The Voice of Noit. That's what they called the release.
And then after that, he then had Cherry-Faced Lurchers.
Yeah.
That was the next stage in Joburg.
When he moved to Joburg.
When I saw him at Box Theatre, there were three-piece band. It was James, Lee and...
Mike Delahunt.
Mike Delahunt.
If he fell off a bar stool...
I remember thinking, how can I have a band without a drummer? Because the punk bands... I'd seen The Clash, you know, and bands like that in London already.
Yeah, and they were driven by...
Punk bands, you had to have a good drummer. There was the one thing. It doesn't matter how bad the band, you know, three chords, whatever. You had a fucking good drummer to play at speed.
Okay.
Do you know anything about Mike? At what point did they substitute him?
But the recording Live at Jameson's, which happened in 1985, was Richard Frost playing drums, Lee Edwards on bass, and, of course, James on guitar, vocal, and composition. So he was a central... figure of all these bands that we talk about here. And then his solo stuff, which we'll deal with in another episode of The Rest is Shifty. And then the later stuff, when he worked with you. And then, of course, his pièce de résistance.
'Cause if we...
Which was Sunny Skies.
Love one another,
where he could, as he said, make it so good.
It would be...
That there would be no argument.
Helpful. Wouldn't be helpful. We'll be right back.
Yeah, so my early days, because we're just building up to this album, a bit of background also. I got together with a guy called Sean Naidu, and we started writing film music together. And Sean studied with James. Sean did a BMus degree, and James was doing a BMus degree in Grahamstown at that point. So he was well-educated in music. You can feel that in his sense of dynamics, the loud and the soft. And James's music always had incredible control
of
the loud and soft. And that was one of his secret weapons in a way. He'd bring it down and kind of talk to an audience and then wind it up.
Yeah, in fact, if you think about it, the first track of this album, Detainees, is exactly that. It starts incredibly soft.
That's right.
And it works up into a number of crescendos, actually. Very much a dynamic song. And that creates the atmosphere, actually, of this loneliness of the prison cell.
The album opens with a ticking clock, which is a nice metaphorical thing.
The atmosphere that it creates, it's like this empty space. The kind of thing that you can imagine a person that's in a solitary confinement cell is feeling, where they've got nothing to bounce off. And when I was mixing it, I was thinking, this carries on a bit long. But then I realized, when you're listening to it, you start to really get the atmosphere of a prison cell.
The song builds. It has this chord crashes through. It's the Beethoven thing of tension and release. James loved Beethoven, and he often spoke to me when we worked together on stuff about tension and release. He said Beethoven was master of dynamics. You've got to have soft and then hit it loud. His music had a lot of tension and release. The other thing that Beethoven didn't have to do was to write lyrics. And James spent a lot of time, and these are very finely crafted lyrics, and it's difficult to do as a white South African to be able to articulate your politics without being gauche or, you know, too...
On the nail.
Yeah. Coming out of punk rock also, we felt a confidence in expressing your own observations and its relevance.
Shackled freedom to the wall. No one to befriend him. No one to talk to about anything at all, except a man. And as the chill gnaws into the night, his only thoughts to warm him, cast into the dark, 'cause he loves the light. He's not a happy man. He's not a happy man.
That is a very good way to open an album like this and set the tone politically too. It was important to set your flag in the sand. And we'd had, Shifty Records had had a number of our artists who'd spent time in detention. In fact, Lesego Rampolakeng wrote a poem that Busi Maxisela recorded. Yeah. Did it beautifully. And Mzwaki Mbuli had whole periods of detention.
Yeah, he was in for 8 months, and I think it really changed him.
So these
were
things
that's what that song's all about.
Yeah, these
were
things that really...
Cast into the dark because he loves the light.
It's almost about someone like Mzwaki. And Lesego also spent time and doesn't talk about... Yeah, people don't want to talk about that. We don't know. And it happened to Winnie too. I think she went through a huge personality change under solitary confinement.
Feel the psychological trauma that somebody might be going through. Alone in a place like that. Not knowing what's happening to their family outside. The family not being able to visit, etc. For me, this was always going to be the opening track.
This song could be anyone in detention anywhere in the world.
Exactly. It's universal.
It's universal. These are universal truths. And I think James was good at saying universal truths.
Heavy O's, the next song on the album, is the same, except it's about O's. For those that don't know what an O is...
Well, let's listen to Heavy O's quickly, Lloyd. What's the very, very first sound we hear? Is it a snare drum?
Yeah, it's like a machine gun.
What is interesting about this, Lloyd, is the beginning using that snare drum like a gun. And then later on in the gap before the pre-chorus, I think, there's this one snare drum hit and then they go in. There was a guy who wrote a whole book on Bob Dylan's song, Like a Rolling Stone.
A whole book on one song?
On that song, yeah. And he spends, I think, the first chapter on that snare drum hit before it starts and just how important that was.
I can hear it in my head.
And in a sense, this has got...
Well, if you're writing a whole book, I'm sure it was very important.
That beginning, that snare drum, using it like a gun is really brilliant. I just want to see if I've got it here.
That's Warwick walking off into his man cave.
Yeah, Grail Marcus, Like a Rolling Stone. I've got it right here. Yeah, he says a drum beat like a pistol shot. 24 July 1965 was the day Bob Dylan's Like a Rolling Stone went into the charts.
That's like 20 years before we recorded this.
Well, there you have it.
Hey?
Exactly
July
20 years.
July 1965, July 1985. There we go. There's the connection. 6 degrees.
When the drummer Bobby Gregg brought his stick down for the opening noise of the 6-minute single, the sound, a kind of announcement, then a void of silence, then a rising fanfare, then the song, fixed the moment when all those caught up in modern music found themselves engaged in a running battle for a prize no one bothered to name, the greatest record ever made.
Quite a claim, but I suppose if you're writing a book about just one song, you'd like it to be the best song that's ever been written. What's the author's name again?
So that's Grail Marcus on the beginning of Like a Rolling Stone, which I thought of immediately with this song, which is quite nice.
It's a statement.
Yeah.
Well, I think it's more of a statement than a single hit.
Later on, there's the single hit. There's that tension, the silence. Then they snare drum, then they go into
the... Tension and release again.
Yeah, it's a really musically nicely done.
Eliminate, eliminate. From childhood you were taught to hate. From childhood you were taught to hate all so-called enemies of the state. The activist, the pacifist, the communist, the unionist, the socialist, the feminist, and anything that comes from Wits.
So that song, if you're a Wits student, anything that comes from Wits is the end of the choruses. You would know exactly what he was saying in that song. These O's are heavy. Because in terms of the white community, the two opposites would have been the people that joined the police and then the Wits students, who were the liberal, you know, so it's the conservative fascist against the liberal thinker, essentially. So this is the point of view of this song, looking at the fascist element of society.
And at this time the song was written, there was a lot of beating of students on Wits campus.
There was a lot of beating
There's
of students.
There's a lot of footage of that, in fact.
Tear gas.
Yeah, that's right. The states came out very, very heavily against students and people protesting against their policies. So Heavy O's was about the police. The police were the Heavy O's. And as we said before, a universal heavy person, which as we speak today, we're seeing happening in America. You know, there's this definite sense of Heavy O's out on the streets, beating people up and dragging them out of work, locking them up, detaining them without
trial. Those
are Heavy O's. So it's a universal song. I must say, you're right, Heavy O's are everywhere. When I was in London in 79, I got punched by Heavy O's going into the tube. And it never happened to me in South Africa, ever. These guys just leaned over
like
the... They were rockabillies or something. They had Mohicans and kind of chains and stuff, like skinheads. Yeah. But they had hair. Well, they had a bit of hair in the front.
In the middle.
The guys leant over the escalator and hit me in the face.
Just because you didn't like your face or because it just hit you?
Yeah. Just a heavy O.
That's a heavy O.
What
people would like a definition.
Yeah, that's a heavy O.
Yeah, we had quite a few of them here.
Yeah.
And they didn't like our black brothers at all. And they liked us probably even less, actually.
Yeah, sellout. Yeah.
Exactly.
Eliminate from a childhood we were taught to hate, enemies of the state, all these things, socialists, feminists, communists, unionists, these are all things that are currently...
Or anyone that comes from Wits.
Brilliant lyric. And the other important thing about the lyric is it's still got a... a cheekiness, which is James. He had that mouth. He had a,
he had
a fucking cheekiness and attitude, hoden, they used to call it in the army. They don't like your hoden, they don't like your spirit. And that comes in with the word O's, heavy O's, is a colloquialization for people who are not from South Africa. These O's are heavy, they'll fuck you up. So a little bit of a smile, brings a bit of a smile to your face at the end of quite a heavy lyric. He does that. He's very good at that.
The interesting thing is in the chorus, the tension that keeps on rising when he keeps on mentioning these things that the heavy O's don't like.
Yeah, the list.
So that's also beautifully done in terms of the tension and release thing.
It's like a rap, actually. Yeah. There is that silencer and then the snare, and then it goes.
The snare?
Yeah.
Right.
How did this come about, Lloyd? How did you start off recording it?
The idea was to do a studio album. I mean, James really wanted to do a studio album after the Live at Jamison's.
So the gap between this album, the Cherry Faced Lurchers Live at Jamison in 1985, and the second album that the Cherry Faced Lurchers did, which is the other White album, what happened during that gap? Why is there such a long gap?
There's not a long gap, actually. It only feels like a long gap because it was only released properly 30 years later.
And why was that?
So I think we started recording that the next year, actually in 1986. All the backing tracks were done. It probably would have been over a couple of weeks, but it was really the overdubs that took the most amount of time. And there was big gaps in the session. So sometimes it would have been months worth of gaps in the sessions. And it went into 1987 because there was a lot of problems with the sessions. There's a change in drummer, firstly. It started off with Richard Frost on drums, Mark Bennett on keyboards, Lee Edwards on bass and James Phillips on guitar vocals. Then Steve Howells pulled into drum, I think it was in 1987, and the other three members remained the same. James had already started drinking quite heavily, and I had a real problem with getting the right sound out of his voice. And I did those vocal sessions over and over again. But the interesting thing is that when I revisited this album during COVID, because, you know, everybody had lots of time all of a sudden to actually do the things that had been on the back burner for ages, I found James's voice very poignant.
And even the big crowds can leave you cold. Leave you cold.
I suppose maybe it was my nostalgia, but I'm not sure.
And even your best friend can be so.
But when I revisited it, I found the songs really held together and the vocals actually held them together the most.
Sometimes I wonder if I'm ever going to make it out of here and home again. You know those places get so dark and lonely and you think it'll soon be over.
I had a number of takes to choose from. I spent a nice long time mixing the album and I'm very happy with the way it's come out. And that's, in a way, why we're doing this podcast now, is because it's finally coming out digitally.
If I recall, there was a cassette called The Other White Album.
There was, but we kind of rushed that out in about 1990 or so.
So those are different mixes.
Those are different mixes.
So anyone
same
who has
songs?
That cassette,
yeah,
same songs, but a very different mix.
Yeah.
these mixes you did since.
Exactly.
Yeah, okay. And then it was this is pressed as vinyl, and it's available on Bandcamp as well.
Yeah, where you get your music. So on Spotify, et cetera, et cetera. The next song is interesting, Warwick, because I think that you might be able to give a bit of background to this one.
Is this Barbed Wire?
Yeah, this is all about a friend that writes a letter from England to James.
I got your letter today. It talked about the gray and rainy weather. You sounded so far away, and I could hear your voice. It was the laughing.
At that stage, he'd never left the country. So he was reading this thing of a friend of his experiencing being overseas.
He talked about the things I wonder that are there. I still wish I could see them. Of all the places that I ever read about, you say you could do without them, yeah.
Overseas for him was a huge thing, going overseas. And that's why part of the lyric says, you can do without the wonders that you see there, but I'd still like to see them.
And the band's amazing there, but the working class, they couldn't get much poorer.
Yeah, but see, that's for me, that was the whole thing about James's longing for the overseas.
Yeah.
Because he'd heard so much about it. He's, you know, he's been influenced by American bands. Obviously, the Europe thing was there because a lot of our forebears came from that continent, the white South African forebears anyway. So there was kind of a longing in that lyric as well. Like, you over there in exile or whatever.
Yeah.
I kind of wish I could see what you can see. But at the same time, you're going to be back. No matter what,
because your letters
South Africa
are not
tit place.
And yeah, exactly.
It's warm. It's not grey and rainy. So I think this friend that he's talking about here is a person that I actually made a documentary about James with, a very, very good friend of James named Robbie Thorpe. Let's quickly listen to the intro of that film.
When I was putting on the suit today, I was kind of struck by the irony of getting dressed up for James. The man with the loneliest hairbrush in show business. James is many things to many people. Rock star, writer, composer, a lover of everything South African, always late, messy, master of the cold shoulder, a friend, simply James.
Just when we thought it's over.
James Phillips was a musician and composer who sang songs about the country he loved and sometimes hated. Some say he was the voice and conscience of a generation of white South Africans, and yet most of you wouldn't have heard of him. He was a close friend of mine who I watched destroy himself slowly, maybe because circumstances denied him the recognition he deserved, or maybe because that was his fate.
I think maybe you came across Robbie over in England, Warwick. I think you stayed in the same place at one stage.
Yeah, Robbie came over. I was in London in 1986. I played concerts there, and I stayed with the guy who ran the record company that released my albums, Chris Cutler. And he had an old school that they had kind of squatted. It was a legal squat. They were paying rent and everything, but the place was completely fucked. And they repaired it. They repaired the water and things like electricity and all that, which had been destroyed. And it became a bit of a place for people to pull in. After I was there, South Africans started pulling in.
Because you were there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Robbie was, I think, probably, even Philip Tabani, Opa, the percussionist.
Yes.
Yeah, he stayed a night. So it was a kind of a spot, you know, you could come and it was a big place. There were lots of rooms and stuff, and they always made you welcome. And Robbie came over. It was interesting to look at England through Robbie's eyes, who, you know, he's always the jaundiced eye.
The cynic.
And there were things about London, obviously, that were tough for exiles. People, we met a lot of exiles.
Okay, so why was Robbie exiled? Why did he exile himself?
I don't think he did, Lloyd.
Oh, okay.
I think he just came over for a visit.
Oh, I see. So he wasn't avoiding the army. But
no, he wasn't a draft dodger. As far as I know, he wasn't a draft dodger.
Oh, okay. But it's interesting because James says in the lyric, you'll come back one fine day, even though the whole force is out to get you.
Maybe it's people often write about composite people.
Yeah, it's true.
You know,
yeah.
There were a lot of draft dodgers. There were a lot of people in Amsterdam. There are a lot of people in London. There are a lot of people who, as they say, shook their trees and got passports out so they could escape the army. So that was a big thing. So it is about exile. The song is about an exile's letters back home, you could say. And there were interesting things that you came across when you were there. For instance, I remember coming across a guy in the street. You know, to be a white South African was you were a pariah of the world, you know. I mean, there was a song, "We Hate You, South African Bastard," that a group called Micro Disney wrote.
And there was also Not the 9 O'Clock News, I think, that
I've never met a nice South African.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. "We Hate You, White South African Bastards" was a song that James wrote an answer to.
That's right.
"We Hate You, Pommy Bastards."
For those of you that bought the vinyl, I'm afraid you wouldn't have had that track on your record, but for those of you that get the digital download, you will have that track.
Oh, is the track on the digital download?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah, "We Hate You, Pommy Bastards."
"We Hate You, Pommy Bastards."
It's an answer to Micro Disney's. What was it called again?
A compilation album called "We Hate You." Yeah, I've actually got the album here. For some reason, they called it "We Hate You, South African Bastards." 1984, they did that.
Oh, but didn't they have a song called that?
Let's just see track listing. I don't think they even bothered writing a song. They've got a song called "Pretoria Quickstep," which I think is as close as they got. I don't think they were the most intelligent band on the planet. But James's answer song to that was phenomenal. I mean, he writes a fucking cutting lyric.
"I should have known you couldn't take a joke. I should have realized you slayed us and judged us, and so just let me tell you now, you started it all. You sent your army across the sea, you spilled blood on our soil. You killed the women, children, everyone. You brutalized nations, you ruled with a gun. Oh no. You can still stand and accuse. Yes, you think you know it all, but you haven't a clue."
No, it's a good comeback.
It's a good comeback.
Yeah.
Because I remember he got so angry, James, about that. He thought it was a song by them, and he'd never heard it or anything. I just showed him that cover. I don't think we even listened to it or anything.
Yeah.
The cover was enough. "We Hate You, South African Bastards." Mm. And then, yeah, the other guys that we never met, a nice South African, the
Not the 9 O'Clock News.
It was with puppets.
Oh, the puppets. Oh.
Puppets. What are they called, man? It was like...
Oh, right. Spitting Image.
Spitting Image, yeah. Mm-hmm. Spitting Image did. So Spitting Image also did a similar thing called "I've Never Met a Nice South African," a song. They wrote a song with a puppet singing it, sort of a humorous, cynical take.
"I've had a close encounter of the 22nd kind. That's when an alien spaceship disappears up your behind. I've got directory inquiries after less than 40 rings. I've even heard a decent song by Paul McCartney's Wings. I've seen a flying pig in a quite convincing wig, but I've never met a nice South African.
No, he's never met a nice South African. And it's not bloody surprising, man, because we're a bunch of arrogant bosses who hate black people."
I remember meeting, for instance, on the streets of London, a guy from the Revolutionary Communist Party. So you had the Revolutionary Communist Party, you had the Communist Revolutionary Party, you had the Communist Revolutionary Tendency. So you had all these splinter groups.
In the UK?
Yeah. Monty Python made fun of it in The Life of Brian, where you had the Palestinian Liberation Front and the Liberation Front of, you know. You remember in The Life of Brian, actually quite prescient, now that I think of it. It was a very similar Judeans People's Front and the Front of the Judean People. You know, it was always, England was full of these incredibly complicated anti-apartheid movements. I think there were two. There was one started by Norma Kitson. There was also Jerry Dammers with his whole operation Rock Against Racism. So the Brits really got onto the anti-apartheid thing, and it struck a nerve. They just really got onto the anti-apartheid thing.
And that big concert for Mandela as well.
And the big concert for Mandela, which apparently... That song, "Free Nelson Mandela," that Jerry Dammers wrote, apparently raised more money for the ANC than anything they'd done. And not only that, I read an article where they said they did a poll and they found that 90% of the people in England knew who Nelson Mandela was.
From that song?
From that song, yeah. So it was an amazing...
The power of music, Warwick.
The power of music. And a catchy kind of a hook.
The hook. Got to have a pop song.
Got to have a good pop song.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know if this one has. I think Heavy O's did, yeah.
No.
So let's move on to...
Well, Deluxe has got a bit of a hook.
Let's hear the hook in Deluxe, Lloyd.
Okay.
The things that make you want to run around town with your pants in your hand. Sing all the songs that have ever been planned. It's just a matter of...
Why would he have called this Deluxe? What was the connection, do you think?
You know, I don't know, Warwick, but also I'm also a bit confounded by some of the end of the chorus lyric.
Do you think he's written it for someone? With running around town with your pants over your head?
No, no. The first one ends with run around town with your pants in your hand.
In your hand.
Sing all the songs that have ever been planned. It's a matter of style. And the end lyric is forget about those things that put your pants on your head.
Yeah, pants on your head.
Because it's not hard to be easily led. It's just a matter of style. I don't know what he is speaking about there.
It's probably an in-house thing to someone he knows who, you know, and this can happen. You can write it for one person, you know. That is also possible. But what is interesting about this song is James, he wrote about death quite often, you know. I've been looking through and I've seen, especially later on, a sort of almost a premonition. Hold on to everything that keeps you looking on the bright side, then it'll take you much longer to die.
That means you're less stressed because you're actually thinking positive thoughts, basically.
It's only serious if it's going to last forever. Mm. It's only serious if you remember all the baddies and the hardies and the meanies.
Which we had a lot of in South Africa.
They're just not built to keep you alive, so if you're wandering from these places, you'll be singing.
Hold on to everything that keeps you looking on the bright side. And it'll take you so much longer to die. It's only serious if it's gonna last forever. It's only bad if you remember all the baddies and the hardies and the meanies. Oh, they're just not built to keep you alive. So if you wander from these places, you'll be singing, babe. You will be singing and forget about the things that put the pants on your head. It's not hard to be easily led. It's just a matter of. It's just a matter of. It's just a matter of style.
I've always loved this song. It's actually on the live album as well.
Yeah, it's on the live album too.
Live at Jamison's.
Live at Jamison's, yeah.
The song Branch, which begins side two, another powerful song that gives you a view into the hectic nature of those times that we lived through.
What a reason to be here. What a heaven to hold. No, baby, I'm not lost without you. I really hope you don't mind. Caught you shocking, something it was, all over the papers. And I read about you every single day. With your briefcase, suit, moustache and sunglasses. And the latest equipment from the CIA. Oh, you lurk in the shadows. And listen to other people's conversations all day. And you take the photos that put the men on the gallows. You took so many of mine, yeah. You took so many of mine. You threw all your calling at 4 a.m, oh. I know Big Brother's on mine, yeah.
finishing that chorus sentence as well. They took so many of my.
They took so many of my.
Exactly. It could be brothers, could friends be friends, away, yeah. Could be our family, it could be.
I mean, this is an extraordinary song. I don't think anyone in South Africa has written a song like this. Like you say, it's like Detainees. It's almost an extension of the same theme.
It is. These are the guys that have put that guy in detention.
In detention, yeah. The branch of the special branch, who were the kind of goon squad who went the special...
They were.
Yeah.
Boss, they were like, Bureau yeah. of State Security were the special branch.
So they were called the branch. This is about the branch.
And you see all your calling at 4 in the morning. Oh, I know Big Brother don't mind. Yeah, and I know the devil don't mind.
You do all your calling at 4 in the morning.
You do all your calling, yeah. Shocking somebody who was all over the papers. Briefcase, moustache, sunglasses. So the tropes of the CIA, the secret police, again, all over the world. It's a generic kind of, it's a trope. And interesting, what I thought here and I liked is the mention of the devil. Is this the first time we hear the devil crop up on these two albums? James uses the devil a little bit more in his later albums and his religiosity. Being a man of gospel leanings, a lot of his stuff comes out of blues and gospel-y influence, you know.
Yeah, there was that whole phase that he went through, James the Baptist, which we'll deal with in another podcast. But yes, he went through the James the Baptist phase.
He was Christian thinking in many ways, which I love about his work. It's starting to come through now. You feel it in this song, particularly a sense of the evil and the devil there. Yeah, it's the yin and yang kind of thing, the voice of Noit and the voice of Yah. James went through life, I think, with a lot of complex things about the voice of Noit and the voice of Yah. So the devil pops up here, actually. And it's a blues image as well, you know, the devil at the crossroads and all that. It's a wonderful character to throw into songs.
Except you don't get to make a deal with this devil. He's the one that takes the pictures that puts you on the gallows.
No wonder this country's so crazy. They take the holy word and bend it anyway. And Johnny Marshan is all alone in his nightmare. What did you do to his mind? Yeah, what did you do to his mind?
Interestingly, that these tropes that he goes through have appeared later on, and especially recently in the book on Nelson and Winnie that John Steinberg wrote, goes quite a lot into the torture that Winnie suffered, and the guy called Roy Ross Swanepoel, who is a very important character in bringing European torturing methods that he learned in France. Apparently, Joe Slover said that before Roy Ross Swanepoel, there was no torturing as such, and the police usually stayed within the law, albeit apartheid law. Roy Ross Swanepoel came back with torture techniques that weren't within the law. According to Slover, he said that was kind of the beginning of the floodgates opening for secret torturing. And
so that would have been post-76 maybe even?
Yeah, I think, yeah, 70s, yeah, yeah.
When did Biko die?
77.
77, yeah. So yeah, maybe the
mid-70s. Mika was subject to those sort of tortures that were, and Winnie was particularly badly tortured by...
Winnie Mandela.
Roy Ross was the guy who did it to her. Thereafter, obviously, the Minions took over, but he was the first wave.
So he was the devil.
He was the devil. But anyway, so that's interesting that these are things that he's written about, James, that later were concretely proven.
But everybody knew it.
Everyone spoken. We'd know. All you had to do is speak to some of our artists and so on. And we knew about black and white people who'd been tortured.
It's
psychiatric wards. You know, he's got everything here, the 10th floor. Anyway, yeah, so I think James really captured a lot of the zeitgeist of what was going on, yeah, in a song. It's really damn difficult to do, and a phenomenal lyric.
For me, this is the thing about this album. It is a window into that period.
Yeah.
From a certain point of view, from our community's point of view, really, which is liberal thinking, whiteys, urban dwellers, living in a place like Joburg and seeing what's going on around you. Each of these songs speaks to that. Most of them are quite hectic, just in terms of the message that's carried by the lyric. But every now and again, there's a song where you feel that the pressure has been let off, like the Keros, who were a band that also played at the Jamisons that James used to enjoy watching, headed by Gary Hurstelman, who we will be doing a podcast on one of these fine days.
And and James liked to refer quite often. I mean, the carols is, yeah, it's, play it, Lloyd. Let's listen to carols
okay.
again.
All right.
You know, I like to be there when the carols play that rock and roll. There's no ifs or buts about it.
Is it a Beatles kind of a...
Yeah.
Or was it Beach Boys? Yeah, well, anyway, it's certainly capturing an era with that stylistically, that 60s pop. Let's hear the chorus.
Because it keeps me warm and gentle. Because I'm so insecure. It's not I don't like metal. Some things are better than them, that's for sure.
I can completely visualize the scene.
That's for sure.
That he's imagining there, which is clutching a beer by the neck so he doesn't get it warm, and swaying to the carols.
So it's got a feeling of a 60s pop song. It's got that lightness, where the carols are a heavy riff-based band, fucking speedy and very different to that feel.
But funny. That's the thing that lifts the spirit that he's talking about, that these boys can save your soul.
You know I love that music. When it's right.
Yeah, but this has almost got a... It's a carols, but he's almost doing it in the style that Jonathan Handley would have done it. It's almost a Jonathan Handley lyric in a way. You know, Jonathan is able to bring in...
Springs.
Springs. And yeah, sort of a, doing a T-Rex song, but he'll bring springs into it.
Oh, it'll pick up your heart and make you feel like you've got it, the body and soul.
This feels like that as well. It's got a very Springs feel, actually.
Well, they both come from Springs.
Yeah, it's actually got a Rats feel. It could almost be a Rats riff. You can imagine Dave singing it.
Cool.
You see what I'm getting at? It's
maybe
got,
we
got
should get him to sing it for the James Cavalier
good idea.
Album.
Get Dave to sing this, yeah. Song about the carols, sung by the Rats, written by James. That's a great combo. So anyway, that's my take on it.
But some things are better, baby, and that's for sure.
And I like the Save Your Soul, again, going back to gospel.
Yeah.
You know, James loves savings of souls and the devil. It's a very important part of his psyche. His soul. He's worried about his soul.
No, I think his soul will be all right.
His soul will be absolutely fine, yeah, but yeah. He was worried about his soul. That's the voice of Noit, you know.
The
voice of Yahan Noit.
Yeah.
What do they call it? The double bind. Philosophically, I like Shout. So it's one of my favorites, actually. Yeah, so this is definitely one of his positive songs.
It is, but it's all about how we wreck in the world, Warwick.
Yeah, but it's a thought. It's a positive thought. The world is a holy place.
Shout! Because we can still save.
And we can save it.
We can save
it. If we
it,
save
yeah.
ourselves. But we can only save ourselves if we save the world. Which is a positive message, but it also indicates the fact that we're fucking it up, right?
We can save the world.
Yeah, we must not take.
And never think of giving.
And never think of giving. Those are universal, again, universal lines. Also a kind of a, almost a rock pop cliche style, you know, that he's using to give this message. And it's kind of a little bit of like preacher man delivery too, you know, in the way that those black preachers would do.
Yeah.
You know, they build the audience.
Yeah,
build
a crescendo.
It. The message above the noise, shout above the noise. It's a signal to noise. It's the title of my thesis was the idea of trying to break through the noise. Shout. So if you want, it's about protesting.
It is.
Yeah.
It's our actually protest about shout and fixing what we've
fucked up. Yeah, that's why I say it's positive. Shout above the noise, shout and protests. Yeah, yeah, that's what it's about. The age-old thing of if we take the time and energy. You know, if I have to think of the Americans now, of people being dragged out of the offices and stuff, they're not used to it anymore. They've been complacent for years and years and years, since the Vietnam War. They've let the sponge take over, you know. It's a bit like we were complacent and Zuma took over. Well, as soon as you relax, you know, the negative people on the planet, the destructive forces just move in.
And it's just a wave after wave.
That's my feeling anyway.
Right now, we record this.
Yeah, we've got a shout. We've got a shout above the noise.
The generals and their lethal toys.
But some of our voices have gone from all the shouting.
And we're too old to shout now, worry
exactly.
Just about.
Got frog in throat.
But we can do a podcast.
We can do a podcast with frog in throat. No, I think it's a call to arms. That's what they call it.
It's interesting that he chose to do the song again ages later on the Sunny Skies album.
Yeah.
With a fantastic turn by Gloria Bosman on that particular
version. Yeah, it was really good. And the brass is so nicely done, and it's beautifully recorded too. You can, you know, the brass is fat.
Oh, thank you, Warwick. And Willem producing, Willem Moller.
Has it got a guitar solo on?
Does certainly have a guitar solo.
Yeah, that's a hell of a solo. Hey?
Yeah, not on this version, but on the
On that other one, Sunny Sky version. Yeah, that's right. It's a killer solo.
Yeah.
Very controlled. Mm.
Lovely sound as well.
Beautiful sound,
You can hear the cardboard in the speaker, you know, that cardboardy sound.
Yeah, and you can hear the plectrum crack on the, very cool.
Trade spotting.
A 1, a 2. Okay, let's do Better Way, the last track on the album. What struck me about this again is the blues, the Prison Gang song. I'm sitting here lonely like a broken man. Yeah, so it's got that, and it's about bureaucracy.
It's a cold morning and I cannot wait to get right out of this place. You know the boss, so he drives me up the creek, and I only get paid once a week, and I've got to break these chains from around my feet.
The boring nature of urban life.
Yeah.
Nobody notices you. Nobody knows who you are.
All the people that I met in my time, I never met, didn't grumble and whine about the lots of 9 to 5.
Again, a generic kind of a look at to staying alive.
Working for some other guy, baby.
Like a lot of people do, particularly in, I have to think of my son in England right now, you know, having to work from 9 to 5 to stay alive.
This song is probably the least related to being in South Africa, you know, apart from the fact that it is also universal. Eventually escaping to the place where the whistle don't blow and where the river flows. So it's that old hippie kind of idea of escaping the rat race. And to nature.
Yeah, this is more of a sort of slightly tongue-in-cheek, it's more like the Kinks or something, you know, those sort of songs that Ray Davies would put together. Lazy Sunday afternoon kind of vibe, you know, cruises along.
Waterloo Sunset.
Mm. Yeah, so he's the musician in a way. It must be a better way, singing about a previous life or singing about his life now that he can't.
Well, he never really had a job, James, so, you know.
But also he wasn't really a professional musician. You know, he wasn't.
He was, but I mean, the fact that he'd never earned money from it.
Yeah, exactly.
So they couldn't say that it was a profession.
Yeah, that's the band that a lot of artists are in.
But, you know, it's interesting you should say that because, I mean, probably the best songwriter that either of us have ever worked with.
And probably the most skilled musician I've ever worked with.
And probably the most skilled musician as well. And certainly in terms of his approach to songwriting and the lyric content of his songwriting, I mean, he just painted a scene that we're all so aware of, but in such a way that it just felt poetic. No hitting the nail on the head. It was all so perfectly crafted in a way.
He had a conceptual sense of the song and the album. For someone who studied music, it's really hard to learn something like that. I think Steely Dan are the only people I know who studied music and came out of it writing songs that had all the stuff, you know, really incredible musicality and lyrics. Not many. Mm. You know, I can't think of many people.
You mean either just, it's from the gut?
Or it's music, like Beethoven, you know, but to combine words as well.
Right, I see what you mean.
So, and because with words are the concepts. All these albums that he's done.
If you're to look at the musicality of this particular album, obviously there's a big jump between this one and Live at Jamsons in terms of the actual composition.
Yeah, you can hear his musicality, key changes and stuff, and then all those, what Ian Herman used to call clever chords. He had a lot of clever chords, modulations, and that comes out later in the album after this.
Just want a better
You've been listening to The Rest is Shifty. For more information, go to shifty.co.za. Or for downloads, find us on shiftyrecords.bandcamp.com.